Hi, and welcome to Keeping Up with Public Health from the Western Region Public Health Training Center. I'm your host, Sana Khan. Each week, I'm going to chat with the most active public health researchers about the latest developments in public health, from vaccinations and foodborne illnesses to tobacco policies and climate change. Learn about practical applications of the latest research underway at the University of Arizona's Mellon Enid Zuckerman College of Public Health. Today, I had the privilege of speaking with Dr. Casey Ernst. Dr. Ernst joined the faculty in 2008 as an infectious disease epidemiologist. Her primary projects examine the environmental determinants of vector-borne disease transmission and control, primarily dengue and malaria. Locally, Dr. Ernst takes an active role in working with the local health departments to examine questions related to vaccine-preventable diseases. Her work seeks to understand the reasons behind increasing vaccination exemption rates in Arizona and the development of programs to increase vaccination uptake. Welcome, Dr. Ernst. Thank you for joining me here today.
Thank you very much for having me.
My first question is, how is climate change impacting infectious disease epidemiology? So maybe the link there isn't super clear to people, but there is a link between infectious disease epi and climate change. So if you could discuss that.
Absolutely. So it's pretty complicated, especially when you think about multiple disease systems. But there are certainly some infectious diseases that are more what we call climate sensitive than others. So there's a lot of literature looking at vector-borne diseases, diseases that are transmitted by ticks and mosquitoes and triatome bugs, et cetera. But also waterborne diseases and foodborne illnesses can be considered climate sensitive. So anything that has some sort of temperature component or precipitation component that is involved in the ecology of the infection is likely to be impacted by climate change. A good example, one of the easiest examples, is something for a mosquito-borne disease. So When it's really hot, the mosquito goes from egg to adult much more quickly. So that means you can have an increase in the population size of mosquitoes much more rapidly under warmer conditions than you would under cooler conditions.
Definitely.
And that's just one small sort of aspect of how it could influence an infectious disease transmission dynamic.
Yeah, which is crazy because you don't necessarily think of mosquitoes when you're thinking about climate change, but you do have those cycles of the egg and everything. Mm-hmm. You explained it much better than what I learned from when I Googled it. But another aspect of climate change is extreme weather events. So hurricanes, droughts, extreme cold, that also has an impact directly with human health. Is that correct?
Absolutely. So climate change, if you sort of step back and really think about what climate change is, essentially what it means is we have excess greenhouse gases in our atmosphere, so CO2, methane, et cetera. And what that does is it kind of creates like an insulating blanket around the Earth. And when you have warmer temperatures, that's going to lead to changing weather patterns. And those changing weather patterns are then going to sort of lead into sort of the second tier effects, which would be changes in land use, land cover, ag production, food production, and then those then cascade into more third order sort of impacts. So impacts on the ecology of an infectious disease, for example. And one of the things that I've been worried about recently are fourth order impacts. So as you sort of cascade through this series of events, you're going to have changes to your social systems, your political systems. You may have people who lose their livelihoods, who now have to migrate to other locations to find viable employment. A whole sort of – it's one of those things. It's like this very fundamental shift that can have cascading effects in many ways that we probably haven't even thought of yet.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you brought up the direct impact climate change has on people's livelihoods, because that is something, when we talk about climate change in the news, I think we generally tend to talk about it on a big picture scale and what's going to happen to the Earth and the environment and, 2050, 2070, what do these years look like? But I think a really important detail that gets lost in the climate change discussion is how it impacts our most vulnerable populations. Mm-hmm. And how it disproportionately impacts the most vulnerable populations. So in addition to losing livelihood, what are some other ways that climate change impacts these populations in a harsher capacity than those who may be more privileged?
Right. So in climate change, we talk a lot about communities and individual resilience, which means your ability to come back even if you have a setback. And so if you're working with people who are in poverty, who are already sort of right on the edge and mm-hmm. barely able to make it, if you have an extreme heat event, for example, and they aren't able to afford electricity for their air conditioning, if we're mm-hmm. looking at the United States, they could be very vulnerable to heat stroke and heat death in ways that people who are wealthier, who have more resources, could just, you know, pay that $300 or $400 AC bill and other people cannot.
Yes.
So that's one very clear-cut example of how it could differentially impact people. But mm-hmm. there are a myriad of ways. So pretty much it's in a way, it's kind of an accelerant. So all of the problems that we already have in existence, climate change just sort of makes those accelerate even faster. So, yeah.
Yeah. And some of those direct climate effects on health that you've talked about are air pollution, allergens, wildfires, mm-hmm. temperature extremes, precipitation extremes, disease carried by vectors, which we've just discussed, food security, and then also something that gets lost in the discussion is mental health and stress-related disorders. So like you mentioned, an increase in an AC bill, that doesn't seem like it's the biggest deal, but when you know, you live in Phoenix, Arizona, which we're really close to, it is a big deal. So this podcast is sponsored by the Western Region Public Health Training Center, and that is Arizona, Nevada, California, and the U.S. Pacific Islands. Mm-hmm. So can you talk about how climate change impacts those island climates more than maybe that we see in the continental U.S.?
Yeah. Absolutely. So, I mean, anytime you're sort of out in an island community, you're more likely to be vulnerable to hurricanes. One of the issues, of course, with hurricanes is that the biggest public health message when there's a hurricane coming is get out of the path of the storm. If you're on an island, it's much harder to get out of the path of the storm. So there is that with the extreme weather events. But there's also sort of longer term gradual changes. So one of the other sort of gradual issues that can occur with island nations is rising sea levels. So as the glaciers are melting, you have this increase in sea level, which can do a couple of things. One, it can flood out people's actual homes. Mm-hmm. But the second thing it can do is it leads to salinization of the soil.
Okay.
And when you have a lot of salt content in the soil, it's very difficult to grow any food. Mm-hmm. And so you have this sort of double issue where not only are you decreasing the size of the landmass, but now you're decreasing the amount of the landmass that can actually produce food for the people who live there. And island nations already have a lot of struggles with food security. So that's a really big concern there.
Yeah. That's not one of the issues that I came across when I was reading, but that's a great point because we should all be trying to get our food from as close as to us as possible already. And so that does create an additional barrier for those people who live on the islands because now we're contributing to worsening the cycle of climate change if we're importing a bunch of food from other places. So could you talk about the food aspect a little bit more? You mentioned food security.
Mm-hmm.
And what can we do? I know it's kind of hard because climate change is this huge, daunting issue, and oftentimes we feel really dejected about how we can't make any personal changes. And it's not as easy to say as if we all switch to not using plastic straws anymore, the problem will be solved. But there are some steps that we can take. And I saw a really great article in the New York Times that was talking about the decisions that we have every day.
Mm-hmm.
So could you talk a little bit more about that and specifically what we eat and how we can kind of change that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we have there's a big footprint, mm-hmm. a carbon footprint for food and food production. Red meat is a really big component.
I know, I don't want to hear you say
it, but it's true. I know. We all like our steak.
I know.
We all like our hamburger. Well, not all of us. Mm-hmm. Let's say not all of us, but it is something that Americans typically like to have red meat, and so do a lot of other places in the world. What I would say is there's nothing that says you can't have that, just have it less frequently.
Yes.
Try to identify sources that are local. Mm-hmm. So here in Tucson, we have co-ops where you can buy a share
CSA.
of a grass-fed cow, mm-hmm. For example, and that's more ethical as well as reduces that footprint. Mm-hmm. And then if you like to have red meat two or three times a week, try having it just once a week. Mm-hmm. Try having a vegetarian meal once a week. So it doesn't have to be all or nothing. I know some people, that's the only way they can do it, is they have to just do it completely. Mm-hmm. But a lot of us, we can just make modest changes. And they may not totally solve the problem, but it's making progress towards trying to solve the problem.
Yeah, it's frustrating when we feel like we can't have, a huge impact, but it does. All those small changes that we make do add up. Definitely the corporations are more responsible mm-hmm. for it, but it is nice to know what we can do on our scale.
And I think the other thing that people can do is become active.
Yes.
Politically. So if you're not aware, the climate strikes are going to be occurring September 20th through 27th. I plan on getting my girls out of school for those. And I think really showing that there's a committed political will to start addressing mm-hmm. this issue is another very important thing that everyone can do, from, just writing your congressperson to, reading more about it and informing yourself, voting with people who actually are sensitive and understand that this is a crisis. There's things that you can do sort of to take action that mm-hmm. are individual and personal as well.
I am so glad to hear you say that. When I was kind of prepping for this episode, I was wondering, do I even address that some people don't believe in climate change? Do I give climate change deniers like a voice on this podcast? And it's not a debate. It is proven. So one thing, a quote of yours that I love from your 2016 UA Science Lecture Series talk on climate change, which I will link in the description of this episode because I encourage everybody to watch it. You stated, "Stop asking people if they believe in climate change and start asking if they understand it." Mm-hmm. So I love that quote. Could you go? Yeah, that's perfect, because we've gotten past the point of asking people about if this is an issue.
Right.
We're almost to the point where we can't even mitigate the issue anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So can you go into detail about that statement? And then also how, if you do run into somebody who is a climate change denier, how do you communicate climate change science to them?
Right. Yeah. So I thought about that because I kept, when people talked to me about what they believed in, it was in things that were not necessarily known. So you have faith in things, you believe in things that are not quite certain. And so I thought, no, the science says that this is happening, and it's happening at a very fast rate. It's going to be, effects are already being felt, and they're going to be felt even more by the next generations. And I think a lot about my kids.
Yeah.
And so I really think that there's a when we say people, you believe it or don't believe it, it's like there's an option.
Yeah.
But there's not an option. It is real. It's true. And so the fact is that it's that people don't understand. I really think people don't understand the process that's happening. People misinterpret that, we had a really big snowstorm. So, I guess, calling it global warming was one of the worst things we probably did.
I mean, and every time there's a huge snowstorm, you will get on Twitter and just see thousands and thousands of tweets saying, "What happened to global warming if there's a
exactly.
huge snowstorm?" So that's one of the misconceptions that you have to deal with. So just, this is your chance to kind of address that on the record.
Yes. So global warming is just talking about that insulating blanket that we now have, which means that overall the global average temperature is increasing. That doesn't mean that everything is always going to be warmer all the time. It means and translates into increasing global temperatures, but also increasing extremes, mm-hmm. which means you're going to have more erratic weather patterns. You're going to have seasons that don't make sense quite like they used to. You're going to have torrential downpours. You're going to have ice storms and hurricanes and other things that may increase because it's just becoming a more volatile mm-hmm. system. That's basically what we're translating into is a more volatile system. And so that is sort of one of the issues that I think people really grapple with is because they experience weather.
Mm-hmm.
They don't see...
Yeah, weather is not... climate.
That's right. Weather is not climate. Weather is what you experience on a day-to-day basis. Climate is what is changing over decades and multiple of, you know, sort of mm-hmm. centuries. That's climate. And that's what, you know, affects weather, absolutely, but it's not the same thing. And so in talking to people, I think it's really challenging. I think one question that one of my colleagues asks people is, what would it take for you to feel that climate change is real? Like, what would it take? What do I need to tell you? What do I need to prove to you?
Mm-hmm.
And so that puts the onus on them to really think about, okay, why don't I think that this is true?
Mm-hmm.
And then if they can come up with a question, then you can have your answers and responses that are countering those sort of myths that they may have. I think a lot of people, if you look at the sort of psychology of climate change, if you think about it, I mean, I work on climate change and it keeps me up at night sometimes.
Yes.
Like literally I wake up in the middle of the night and I think about what the world is going to look like for my kids.
That explains your 3:30 a.m. email about this podcast and climate change. But no, it does
there
keep
you go.
Me up at night too.
Yes.
And I saw that the time on that email and I was like, yes, climate change keeps me up too, Dr. Ernst. Yes.
Yeah, so I think that some people, it keeps them up and it motivates them to want to do something. And some people, they can't face it. They can't face it as this big challenge that we are going to encounter as this global society, and it's just too much for them to really grapple with and deal with. And so you can understand. I understand. I would love to say it's gone away.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to worry about
it's solved.
This anymore. It's done.
Mm-hmm.
It would, you know,
make everyone's lives easier.
Exactly. It would. But the fact is, the more we sort of bury our heads in the sand, the worse it's going to get. And, you know, I think it's going to require some sacrifices and some changes. But I think if we think about the alternative,
mm-hmm. It's not pretty.
We should all be willing to sacrifice something in our short term to make the long term a little bit better.
Yeah. And we do have a responsibility to our future generations, mm-hmm. our children, like you talked about, to kind of, you know, if we're the ones that have kind of created this issue, we should be having a hand in helping solve it.
Right.
I do think one of the issues also, we are probably one of the only nations on Earth that is even still having this debate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of where that comes from is that climate change became politicized in our
right.
country. But like you mentioned, the facts are there and it's not a partisan issue such as, you know, like we can have debates on healthcare. We can have
mm-hmm.
debates on other issues in this country, but climate change is really one that does not have a political party because it does impact everybody.
Absolutely.
So just some key facts that I wanted to read out from the World Health Organization. Climate change affects the social and environmental determinants of health, like we talked about. So clean air, safe drinking water, sufficient food, and secure shelter. Those are problems that affect everybody. And then one more stat, between 2030 and 2050, climate change is expected to cause approximately 250,000 additional deaths per year. So that's a crazy number. And then if you're somebody that is a little bit more responsive to dollar signs and the financial aspect of things, the direct damage cost to health is estimated to be between $2 and $4 billion per year by 2030. So that is crazy. So those stats, again, were from the World Health Organization. So my next question to you would be, what responsibilities do we have in the U.S. as a developed nation to mitigate these climate change issues? And how are we impacting other countries around the world mm-hmm. who are less developed at this point?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, you know, there's a lot of sort of undue burden that's being placed on the shoulders of low-income nations. They want to grow their economies, and what they have sort of available and accessible to them is sort of the lower cost option is to go ahead and keep using fossil fuels,
exactly.
et cetera. But I think there is also an opportunity if we were able to help in our development efforts, et cetera, where we're working with nation states that are sort of in the process of building infrastructure, is to help sort of them avoid the mistakes that we have made, and to mm-hmm. emphasize green planning. And while it's sort of seems crazy that we, as one of the biggest polluters on mm-hmm. Earth, would then dictate to other people how they yeah. should develop, I absolutely understand the irony of that.
It is very ironic.
However, I think that we need to be shifting, but we also need to be helping others mm-hmm. so that when they are building from the first time up, they can do it
yes.
so that their carbon footprint
yes.
is smaller.
Because it is, on one hand, a little unfair that we didn't have to worry about these issues as much when we were going through our own industrial revolution, mm-hmm. when we were figuring everything out. Climate change wasn't the biggest issue on our mind.
Right.
But now it is an issue. And so, yeah, it is hard for us as a country to kind of dictate, oh, you can't use this. You have to make a green plan.
Mm-hmm.
You have to do this. But
mm-hmm.
it is important. That's unfortunately the place that we're at now. So the audience for this podcast are public health professionals. So people who work in health departments, people who might be conducting research or be in academia. So I know we talked about what we can do in our lives as the general public, but how do we address climate change in our work as those
Yeah.
as people who work in public health?
That's a great question. And so one of my graduate students, Dr. Mona Arora, mm-hmm. she just passed her defense. So
congratulations.
Yay. Congratulations, Mona.
Yay.
So she actually did a really neat assessment in her dissertation where she looked at the needs of public health departments as well as what's currently being offered in a lot of colleges of public health.
Yes.
So she looked at the accredited colleges of public health and at their curriculum to see who was actually including climate change content in there. And there's still a big gap.
Mm-hmm.
There's still a lot of colleges of public health who aren't training our sort of next generation on climate change and health issues and how those can be addressed and what the vulnerabilities are, what kind of special circumstances we may need to consider with climate change. And then in the sort of workforce in and of itself, I think understanding what the implications are going to be for your health departments locally
yes.
is really key. And in some of the key informant interviews that she did, she said, you know, I was talking to some people who were more on the policy side, and they said almost all of the reports, like the IPCC report, the Climate Ready Nation, or the National Climate Assessment, they all kind of have an epifocus.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a need to sort of bridge that gap as well so that when we're sort of saying, okay, if you do these risk assessments and you see vector-borne diseases are going to increase by X percent, what does that translate to in terms of policy needs
yes.
and how do we shift our practice? So I think there are multiple things that we can be doing and keeping our eye on. There's some great role models in this. So Columbia University and Yale University both have excellent climate and health academic programs.
Mm-hmm.
And given the University of Arizona's excellence in environmental research, I think, you know, this is a place where we could also sort of be poised to,
yes,
to
definitely.
Really develop that as well.
I'm glad that you brought that up, the local aspect, because we have 50 states here in the U.S., and out of those 50, only 16 states have created a climate change plan in two cities. The two cities are San Francisco and New York City. But I was looking, I'm glad to report that Arizona has one where we live, and it is the states that are going to be most impacted that have started
mm-hmm.
working on that change. But I was looking through the Arizona report yesterday, and like you mentioned, there are a lot of local issues that people in their public health departments can be focusing on. And another thing that you mentioned, which I think is really important, is that everybody brings something different to the table. So that
yep.
collaboration, so collaborating with somebody in policy or maternal and child health
mm-hmm.
and all the different aspects, there is, if we all bring something to the table, that collaboration and that effort can really go a long way locally.
Definitely. I absolutely agree that it's going to require not just, like, you have to think about the public health sort of sector as not just people in the public health department, but it's people who are in electricity and power. It's people who are in water. It's people who are in government, so city officials. It's anybody who sort of touches the lives of the society and making sure that we have good infrastructure. So city planners, there's just an entire slew of people who are working on climate change issues. And a lot of folks have been looking at climate change from a water security perspective, but they haven't brought in the health angle to that. So that's another role that we can play, is ensuring that health is infused in a lot of these other conversations that are going on with climate change.
Moving on to some more general questions that I just, this is a fun question. Are there any books that you've read that have influenced your work, or any basic climate change resources that you would point people to?
Okay, so one that I think is really accessible to the public. There's a woman who has done an excellent job really communicating climate change and climate change science from the climatological perspective. Her name is Catherine Hayhoe. And she has an excellent, she's very good at communicating via Twitter, but she also has a podcast, I guess it is, although I think it's on YouTube, called Global Weirding.
Oh, funny.
and it's great because it really breaks down sort of these complex issues into something that's very simple and understandable. So I would highly recommend that if you're sort of a member of the public and you're really not sure where to get started, that you could look at some of her work.
Yeah, I'll definitely have to check that out. And then just, I guess, a final bow, if you could communicate just one aspect of your research that you've done around this to the general public or the public health workforce, what would that one aspect be?
I think one aspect would be, so I had this conversation with a reporter once. We were on the phone for an hour, and I was talking about vector-borne diseases and their relationship with climate change. And at the end of the conversation, because I was talking about this complex nature, she said, so what you're telling me is you don't really know anything. And so what I would like to end with is that these are going to be complex relationships.
Definitely.
And even if it's complex, even if it looks like there are some things that are going to increase or decrease different aspects of transmission, there will be an effect. And it needs to be examined in the local context. There are people who are working on technological solutions. And so I think that's the good news, is that while we can't rely solely on, oh, they're going to come up with everything to, you know, solve this, and we don't really need to do anything different. We do need to do things different, but you should also rest assured that there are a lot of really great people who are working on new technologies that are going to be able to address some of these issues as well, in terms of climate change mitigation, et cetera. You know, solar power is becoming cheaper, wind, water, et cetera. So I think there are some solutions that are coming, but we still need to keep acting. Climate change is going to underpin a lot of the work that we do, and shoring up communities with resources and trying to give resilience, trying to enhance resilience and adaptive capacity of our communities are absolutely critical at this stage. We can't wait till the crisis is on us. We have to be planning ahead to address those gaps now.
Well, that last sentence is probably going to keep me up tonight because it is true and scary and daunting, and we do have a responsibility to be thinking about our future generations and those that are most vulnerable. Thank you so much for the work that you do, the research you conduct, and just coming. I know you go on a lot of radio shows and podcasts, and just getting the word out here in a very approachable and understandable way. I think that is so important. We really appreciate the work you do. So thank you so much for coming on, and I hope everybody enjoyed the episode.
Great. Thank you all very much for your time.
If you are looking to obtain continuing education credits for listening to this podcast, please head to moodle.publichealth.arizona.edu and click on the Keeping Up with Public Health tab in the WR PHTC section and take the post-evaluation survey for this episode. This podcast is supported by the Western Region Public Health Training Center. You can find more of our work at www.wrphtc.arizona.edu. You can also find us on Twitter at WRPHTC. A special thank you to Eric Healy for editing and producing the show, in addition to creating the music for each episode.